From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump went after Congress again today in a tweet about Russia, blaming Congress, which just passed a sanctions bill that President Trump signed, for what he called the all-time low in the U.S.-Russia relationship. The tweet comes less than a week after the president replaced Chief of Staff Reince Priebus with General John Kelly, who has been touted as a person who can bring order to the White House. Joining us now is Andy Card, who was White House Chief of Staff to President George W. Bush. Andy Card, there's been a lot of talk about whether he can keep the White House under control while still letting Donald Trump be Donald Trump. Do you think John Kelly will be able to do that?
I have great confidence that General Kelly is exactly the right person with the right temperament and background for the job. Yes, I think the question is, will the president let him do it? And so far, General Kelly earns praise from me for the way he entered the role of chief of staff in his very first day and some of the decisions that were made. The president seemed to be backing up General Kelly, and I think that's critically important.
Do you think it's going to be a problem, though, if there are some people, and let's say Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, who still have direct access to the president? They don't have to go through John Kelly to get to him?
Well, you know, there are always people working at the White House. I don't care which president it was who had, quote, you know, access anytime they want. The question is, do they respect the role of the chief of staff? So I wanted to be informed before, during, or after any, you know, engagement with the president. So if I knew before, during, or after any engagement with the president, then I felt that I could do my job. And the president was my ally in telling me who I should talk to, because they may have come to see him if they didn't come to me. So I had actually a wonderful backstop.
How unusual is all this churn in the staff at the White House?
It's not unusual. It's a little unusual that the churn is happening as quickly as it's happened after only a little over 6 months in office. It makes sense to go through these changes when Congress is not as focused as they are during the rest of the year and the media is not as focused, and you can enter after Labor Day with, you know, kind of all cylinders working at the right time to move the engine forward.
But throughout some of this turmoil, I've heard a lot of people say, wait until they have a real crisis to deal with. This is going to be a real problem. You were famously the person who told President Bush about the attacks on 9/11. Do you worry about this administration's ability to respond to a crisis like that if something, God forbid, happens?
Well, I think General Kelly comforts some of the worry that I might have had, and he has led under literal fire. And he also, most importantly, understands that there are consequences to every decision that is made so that you have fewer unintended consequences. And I think that's very important discipline for this White House in particular, and it's very important should there be a crisis that is unanticipated.
I want to ask you about the Republican Party. The president is a Republican, but frequently fights with members of his own party. And this morning he tweeted, "Our relationship with Russia is at an all-time and very dangerous low. You can thank Congress, the same people that can't even give us health care." Do you worry about this intra-party fight between President Trump and the Republicans in Congress?
I do. I don't think the president has embraced his role as the leader of the party. And the leader of the party should be bringing people together in the party, not causing them to divide and splinter and walk away. So I'm hoping that he will work with Congress and members of the Republican Party who serve in Congress to help them find a way to complement with an E, not necessarily complement with an I, but complement with an E, the president's initiatives.
What about the issue of immigration? We heard the president's plan yesterday, which would cut legal immigration by half in 10 years, focus on wealthier, highly skilled workers who speak English. You worked in an administration that tried to pass comprehensive immigration reform that would provide a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. What do you think of what President Trump is up to here?
Well, first of all, what President Trump announced is not relative to all immigration. It's really relative to who is allowed to come in, kind of the green card process. And I thought that it was not irresponsible. I mean, we've had other limits that have been put on green card applicants and people that want to come in and work. So I do think comprehensive immigration reform is desperately needed. And something that President Bush wanted to do desperately was to get an immigration reform package through that would recognize some of the realities of immigration and make sure that people who are following the rules of immigration aren't punished because they follow the rules when others come across our borders illegally and then find themselves at the front of the line when other people have been standing in a line for a very long time and doing everything right and they're denied.
But even when President Bush talked about tightening the borders, he would usually also say, you know, we're a nation of immigrants and that's very important. We're not really hearing that from President Trump.
Well, I'm going to give the president the benefit of tunnel vision on this one. I think he was talking specifically about those who come in to meet the needs that the green card helps to address. And I don't think that it was a bad proposal to put forward. I just wish the rhetoric around it had been more inclusive.
That's Andy Card, who was chief of staff to President George W. Bush. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And we're also talking today with Leon Panetta, who is chief of staff to President Clinton. If you miss it on the radio, you can listen at hereandnow.org.
Well, before the announcement yesterday on legal immigration, the president's crackdown on illegal immigration was affecting not just those who have committed crimes, but anyone in the country illegally. The administration says it's intent on enforcing the law and making the country safe, and that's led to more than 100,000 arrests so far this year, according to the federal government. That includes hundreds of people in upstate New York, where the crackdown is forcing many migrants into hiding. Zach Hirsch from Here Now contributor North Country Public Radio reports.
An SUV rolls up a gravel driveway and a man hops out from the back seat. We're in upstate New York in Washington County, a place with a lot of dairies and rolling hills. The man wears a baseball cap, a t-shirt, and jeans. He's from Mexico, here illegally, and these days he avoids going anywhere he doesn't have to.
Well, the safe place for me is home. When I get home, I don't think about it like to go anywhere else because as soon as I get home, I'm stuck here.
He didn't want to be identified, not even with a first name or with the work he does. He says he came here 17 years ago to make a better life for himself.
In Mexico, it's tough, you know. Like, there's not really too many jobs. The United States, like, you want to work, you have a job.
He did find a job right away, and now he owns his home with his wife, who's a U.S. citizen. He tried to get a temporary work visa, but was denied. During the interview process, his family says he admitted he had entered the country illegally. He's always had to lay low, but he says he feels more anxious with President Trump in the White House, in part because in June, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, arrested 27 undocumented people right nearby in Saratoga Springs.
That's another place I have to stay away from.
ICE spokesman Khalid Walls said Mexican and Guatemalan men were arrested on a range of violations. There's no indication that any were accused of violent crimes or posed an immediate threat to public safety. And that's what's new here. Federal officials say anyone found in violation of immigration laws can be arrested and deported. ICE Director Thomas Homan was very clear recently at the White House.
Because there has been this notion that if you get by the Border Patrol, you get in the United States, you have a U.S. citizen kid, no one's looking for you. But those days are over.
Finding people in this part of upstate New York whose lives have been affected by this policy change is hard because they're scared. They live more underground than ever. I found a local activist who introduced me to a dairy veterinarian who helped me find a farm. Here, the undocumented workers are nervous but willing to talk.
Pero tenemos temor porque que si salimos.
One Guatemalan worker says, we're afraid because if we go out, well, you can't, he says. While we're out, they could catch us and deport us. His wife also works and lives here without legal papers. She says when people do go off the farm to buy food, she prays to God. Into your hands I commit my spirit because I am not a criminal, she says. For me, this is a very sacred country, and I'm grateful that God allows me to be here. Later on, I meet Susan Sanchez in Hudson Falls. She's a Spanish teacher who also gives English lessons to families in the U.S. illegally. She says some of the people who were arrested are her friends.
It was extremely devastating, you know, on many different levels. It scared their children. They don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, so it kind of prohibits them from doing a lot on a daily basis.
While Sanchez and the families she works with are fearful and angry, some people support the government's tougher approach. Brian Getty is a sixth-generation dairy farmer in the town of Hebron in Washington County. Getty says he has a lot of respect for immigrants' work ethic, and he doesn't want to tear families apart. But he thinks the nation's border laws should be respected.
We have to decide as a country, is illegal illegal, or are we going to decide what is illegal and let there be gray areas?
But the truth is, the U.S. has used undocumented workers for decades, and trying to get rid of these gray areas is changing the way life works for people, not only on dairies and in restaurants.
They've stopped coming to church, that they are afraid to come out.
That's Father Tom Babiuch. He's the pastor at St. Joseph's Roman Catholic Church in the town of Fort Edward, where he says 12 undocumented families used to come to worship.
They are afraid to go outside and live a normal life because their children are afraid that, you know, when they go out, you know, their parents will be taken away from them or arrested and separated from them.
Babiuch is an immigrant himself. He was born in Poland, and he's now a U.S. citizen. He wishes his parishioners could come out of the shadows and get legal status. But it's not so easy for them, he says, especially now. For Here and Now, I'm Zach Hirsch.
And a story now that's sending shivers up the spines of college-bound freshmen. Recently, the University of California, Irvine, withdrew offers of admission from 499 incoming freshmen, something schools can do, read the small print, because of missing documents or grades that plummet at the end of senior year. But rarely are this many rescinded. The school said 104,000 students applied, over 7,000 were invited to come, but 850 more than the school expected took them up on it. Now, UCI swears no offer was rescinded because of the response, but because students made mistakes and that they can appeal. Wednesday night, the chancellor of UCI, Howard Gilman, issued a statement saying, effective immediately, all students who received provisional acceptances into UCI will be fully admitted, except for those whose transcripts clearly indicate that they didn't meet our academic standards. He also said the stories of our students whose college dreams were crushed by our decision to withdraw admissions to hundreds are heartbreaking. Well, let's hear one of those stories. Arthur Simswamko is a prospective freshman from Lancaster, California. His appeal is one of those still pending. But Arthur, what'd you think when you first heard from the school? We are sorry to inform you the offer of provisional admission extended to you by UCI must be withdrawn.
I was just in total shock, honestly, with all that was happening because I assured myself that I've completed everything, I've met every requirement to the best of my knowledge.
And too late, I'm assuming, to scramble around and look at other schools. So you appealed. Now, what was the reason that yours was withdrawn?
Initially, they told me that there was a discrepancy in my transcript / UC application, meaning that I put a wrong grade or I might have put a wrong class. And what it turned out to be was I signed up for a class in the beginning of the school year, an extra AP class, comparative government. And I initially put that on my UC application, not knowing the workload that I'll have upcoming and in the spring. So I ended up not taking that class. And basically, I forgot that it had to be taken out.
When you applied, you said you were going to take a class. But when your grade transcripts came in, there was no grade because you hadn't taken the class. So in your appeal, what'd you say?
I pretty much stated that not every senior is taught how to do this. Like, this is all our first time doing all this application stuff for college. So it's very difficult to know all the guidelines and all the rules that sometimes we're not told.
As you said, you didn't know. Had you not read that fine print, did you have any idea that after you're accepted, it could be taken away?
No, I was not aware of that whole process of withdrawing my acceptance.
Yeah. What are your parents saying about this?
My parents are really supportive about whatever happens in my life, but they were, of course, also really disappointed. So they've been helping me hopefully have a backup, but we're still really pushing and trying for this school.
Oh, boy, with just a few weeks to go. Well, there is stuff like this that happens. Columbia University sent offers of admission to 277 students, and then an hour later they told them, oops, that was a mistake. Carnegie Mellon and Tulane recently made similar mistakes. In 2009, the University of California, San Diego accidentally told 28,000 students they were accepted. They were actually the students who were denied admission. Look, you're going to get it. You're going to. I just feel a good vibe. But what if you don't? What are you going to do?
Well, I've been thinking about just joining the military, and my dad is telling me that you could do better than that. But that's kind of what I have left other than community school.
You were valedictorian.
Yeah.
Well, that's Arthur Sim-Swamko, one of hundreds whose offer to attend the University of California, Irvine was rescinded. His appeal is pending. Let's get the bigger picture on college enrollment from Peter Farrell, managing director of EAB's Royal & Company division, a firm that helps colleges with marketing. But before that, he helped lead enrollment teams at Fordham, NYU, Hofstra. Peter, this provisional acceptance, the fine print, is it ever enforced as strictly as it was this year?
I think just about every offer of admission has some type of provisional language to protect the university against a student who has a very difficult academic situation or something in their personal conduct that would be objectionable. And, you know, for every college or university, there may be one or two cases a year that they have to take another look at. But for most colleges, the goal is not to disenroll students. The goal is to enroll those students and try to work with them.
What's it like, Peter, when you have to tell someone, we have to rescind, as somebody who worked in enrollment?
I can tell you of all the conversations I had in 25 plus years working on campus, those were the worst conversations I ever had. It's the last thing you ever want to do is to tell a student who thinks that their dreams are coming true and their college choice is all set that that's not going to happen. It's really quite awful.
Mm. Talk about this year. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, predicting what a group of teenagers will do is probably one of the most perilous acts that any group of adults could ever try to enter into, and it's something that colleges try to do every single year. So it's fraught with challenge. And for most years where the environment's pretty stable, colleges are usually pretty good at getting their estimates right on how many students to admit to hit their enrollment numbers on the dime. There's usually a number of attributes, how far a student lives from campus, what kind of academic record they're bringing to the table, the majors that they're interested in, and then there's behaviors that students would exhibit, whether or not they've visited campus, whether or not they've applied for financial aid. And you can put all those together, and you usually get a pretty good read on the likelihood of a student to enroll. But this year was far from stable. There were a lot of complicating factors.
For UCI, it was a doozy of a mistake. Look, you mentioned the factors that might have contributed to that. 2017 was an unpredictable and difficult year for many schools. Talk about those factors. One was related to financial aid.
In two ways. One was that the timing was different. Students could apply for financial aid earlier than ever before in October as opposed to January of their senior year. And the other was that they were using financial information that was from their 2015 tax returns. If you think about the psyche of a family and a student as they were going through the application process this year, in a way like never before, they were applying to college and applying for financial aid at the same time, which had to elevate the idea of cost in that family's decision-making process.
Well, and you say that changed the outcome by a whole percentage point. That's a lot of kids. The other wild card you told us is a change in test scoring, the SATs.
Sure. The SAT went under a big change this year. They really redesigned the entire test. And because it was a new test, how students scored was very different. And the College Board reported back to colleges that they should really estimate about a 40-point swing up or down depending on any individual score, which made it very difficult for colleges to estimate apples to apples. How did their apple compare this year to last?
You also point out that the number of high school graduates is dropping. Now, we remember UC Irvine got 104,000 applicants. So that is kind of counterintuitive because that feels like such a large number. But how would the fact that there are actually fewer high school grads, how would that affect what's happened?
Well, Robin, it's more than just fewer high school graduates. It's the fact that there are fewer high school graduates who are applying to more colleges than ever before. Mm. So every individual student is filing more applications than they did 5 or 10 years ago, which really complicates the math. And add to that, the high school graduates every year are getting more and more diverse, which is just introducing new students to higher education, which is great in so many ways, but complicated in other ways because we're less used to how those students act in the enrollment process.
Well, because the enrollment process is complicated. It feels as if a lot of what happened at UCI is that people, not just the students, but even their guidance counselors, didn't understand.
I think that's a reasonable read of what happened. The enrollment process can be complicated. And when you think about the population of students who are coming forward, we've got more first generation, more students from diverse backgrounds who just have less familiarity with higher education and the way we talk about what we do and the way that we create conditions around our offers of admission. It takes an extra level of communication. It takes a longer conversation that has to start earlier in the high school career in order to help those students successfully find their way to college.
And just give us the bigger picture, though. Other schools did also over-invite, but then other schools missed by going low. So what's the bigger picture about 2017?
Well, the 2017 year is one that I would write as one of volatility, one where we're creating a new baseline for many colleges and universities in the ways that they think about their enrollment metrics. And one where colleges are going to redouble their efforts to create stability in their enrollment pipelines so they can serve students and families better.
What's the one piece of advice you'd give to students, people who are looking down the road at applying?
My advice would be don't be shy about asking for help and advice along the line. Ask away.
Yeah. Peter Farrell, managing director of EAB's Royal & Company division. They help colleges with marketing, but he's also been a lead enrollment manager at several schools, knows of which he speaks. Peter, thank you.
You're welcome.
So, a mistake on a transcript or letting your grades drop, beware senioritis, can get your offer rescinded. Your thoughts on that, welcome at hereandnow.org.
It may just be August, but FedEx and UPS are already thinking about the holidays. FedEx announced yesterday that it will not charge extra fees for most orders during the peak holiday season. UPS, meanwhile, recently announced that it will charge extra fees for peak Black Friday and Christmas deliveries. Both companies are competing to deliver the increasing number of things that we're buying online. Lynette Lopez is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. She joins us from New York. Hi, Lynette.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. And tell us more about these plans from FedEx and UPS. Where would the extra fees be?
So UPS will charge 23 to 79 cents for packages during that period. FedEx will only charge for large packages like $25 for large ones and $300 for what they call unauthorized packages. I guess that's if you're sending a piano or something. I don't know. But you know, this is a strategy from FedEx to say, hey, choose us. It's going to be an incredibly, obviously, hot time for packages. And analysts expect online sales to jump 17% this holiday season to $107 billion.
But how do you make sense of the fact that they're doing these two different things, that one of them is saying we're not going to charge these extra fees and the other is saying we are?
I'm not here to give free advice, but No Fee FedEx is a pretty good slogan. I mean, this is something that they can do to stand – FedEx can do to stand out against USPS or UPS. UPS is making the gamble that you're not going to notice the, you know, 79 cents or whatever they charge you for your package.
Now, Amazon –
and they can make millions.
Amazon is developing its own delivery network as well with Prime airplanes and trucks. Earlier this year, the company even got a patent for delivering packages via underground tunnels. Are UPS and FedEx at risk from Amazon's plans?
I think we are all at risk. I am at risk from Amazon's plans. Amazon's underground tunnels may not be as, you know, sexy as Elon Musk's Hyperloop, but the company does tend to get things done. And Jeff Bezos is never afraid to invest a lot of money in whatever his dreams are. And they have a lot to gain from doing something like this. They spend $700,000 an hour around that number on packages. Hmm. So if they cut that cost, they could save $3 per package. And, you know, that's the dream. fatter margins. And they've gone to – Amazon has been going to war with FedEx, by the way, for a little while now. FedEx recently got into the warehousing business. So if you're selling something, you're an artist or whatever, you want to keep your wares somewhere, FedEx will keep them and ship them for you, kind of as a competitor to Amazon's marketplace.
How does the U.S. Postal Service fit into all this?
The USPS is going to keep chugging along. The federal government, I think, is, you know, watching from the sidelines, a little bit, you know, concerned about this competition. But as long as Americans become more and more obsessed with sending each other or shopping online and sending each other packages, it's going to be more and more of a business money fest. It's a money pile.
That's Lynette Lopez, who is senior finance correspondent for Business Insider. Sending any pianos this year, Lynette?
No pianos.
No pianos.
No pianos.
All right. Well, thanks so much.
No problem.
The music of composer Shimon Lax. You'd be forgiven for not immediately recognizing the name, but how about if we said he was one of the conductors of the prisoner orchestra at Auschwitz during the Holocaust? Lax was born in Warsaw, Poland in 1901. He moved to Paris in the late 1920s. He was a violinist in cafes, taught and composed. And when the Nazis occupied France, he eventually was sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau, where his musical ability probably saved his life. But his refusal to say that music had some sort of transformative impact on prisoners ran against the popular narrative, one reason why his work before and after the war has largely been lost to history. Enter Canada's ARC, or Artists of the Royal Conservatory Ensemble. They've been recovering music of the Holocaust era and just released an album of Shimon Lax's work, Music in Exile, Volume 3, Chamber Works by Shimon Lax. And ARC Ensemble Artistic Director Simon Weinberg joins us from the CBC studios in Toronto. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And so the way I put that theory of Shimon Lax, I picked it up from your thoughts in the liner notes to the new CD. Tell us more about this, that he refused to credit music with some sort of redemptive power in these horrendous concentration camps. What did you mean?
Well, I think we all like to believe that music has this kind of transformative power, that it can give something other than something superficial like entertainment, that it kind of opens the soul and it reveals things that otherwise we wouldn't hear. In the case of Lax, he just refused to believe that. His evidence, and he stuck by this his entire life, was that it had no meaning, really, that it was part of the madness of Auschwitz.
Well, we picked up his memoir, Music of Another World. He puts it pretty strongly here in the overture, the introduction. He writes, most of the books on the German concentration camps mention that there were these musical groups, their role to play marches and such. There are many that claim, not without a certain emphasis, that music kept up the spirits of the emaciated prisoners, gave them the strength to survive. Others assert that music had a directly opposite effect, that it demoralized the poor wretches and contributed instead to their early demise. I personally share the latter opinion.
Yes, I do too, actually.
Yeah, because why? Why would it not only not be transformative, but it would lead to an earlier death?
Well, I think we like to imagine that music has this power. And I think when you think of music outside of horrific circumstances like those of Auschwitz, then you can imagine those things. But as soon as you put music into the context of Auschwitz, it becomes something very, very different.
It's hell, he wrote. It's hell.
Yes, absolutely. And I think having music in the context of something so horrific, it makes a mockery of music in a sense.
you also say that, you know, he didn't put that experience, that horrific experience of being in the camps, in his music, you know, by and large. But now you can't listen to his music without feeling that you're hearing it. Let's just listen to a little now. This is some of Shimon Lack's beautiful music released from the Arc Ensemble in Canada. And Simon Weinberg, as I said, that feels so poignant. I feel like I'm hearing him speak through the music about the Holocaust, but he's not, or at least he generally wasn't.
What you're doing is in the trade known as backshadowing. Huh. You're putting what you know about the context of his life and putting it onto the music. If you heard that without any knowledge of who the composer was or what he had been through, you would say, what a delightful, charming, romantic, wistful piece. But because you know something about his background, the temptation is to impose that on what you're hearing.
And yet you write in the liner notes that his, is it Pascal?
Yes.
1945 might be his attempt to express the inexpressible. Let's just listen to a little. Why do you think this might be more of the Holocaust experience than others?
That's played on the clarinet, but it was originally written as a vocalese. So the singer would just sing to the syllable R. So there were no words. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is the indication, part of the indication, as well as the language of the piece itself, that he was trying to put across some kind of reaction to his experience in the war. But that's the only piece, really, that I get that feeling. And it was written right at the end of the war. It was written just after he arrived back in Paris in May 1945.
Say, in addition to his narrative being different from others, you know, his saying that no, music was not redemptive for us, you say the eyewitness accounts he gave of imprisonment were so searing that they eclipsed his music.
Yes. I think for students of the Holocaust and people who have studied it, the account, Music of Another World, in which he explores those years in which he was in Auschwitz and then afterwards in Dachau, in Kaufring 11, which was a subcamp, his description of what went on there is so fascinating and detailed that in a way it supplanted any attention that might have been paid to the music. The other thing, of course, is that he survived the war. I mean, he died in the 80s, and in a sense, he doesn't really qualify for Holocaust status because he didn't die. People are much more interested in the composers who were actually killed in Auschwitz because there's a kind of compensatory quality that the works have when they're played after the composer's death. He never qualified, in a sense, yeah, because he lived for many years after the war.
And Simon, we just want to ask about ARC, the Artists of the Royal Conservatory of Canada Ensemble. Spent the last dozen years or so appraising and recovering composers who were suppressed or repressed by the Nazi regime. How many are we talking about?
I don't know, actually. We keep turning up these composers, émigrés, who were just utterly marginalized after the war.
Well, and the most recent, the subject of your new album, Music in Exile, Volume 3, Chamber Works by Shimon Lax. Simon Weinberg, Artistic Director of the ARC Ensemble of Canada, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has been paying close attention to the special election in Alabama to fill Jeff Sessions' Senate seat, which Sessions left to become the Attorney General. McConnell is backing Luther Strange in the primary against fellow Republicans Mo Brooks and Roy Moore, two conservatives who have both been critical of McConnell's leadership in Washington. The primary is August 15th. Joining us now is Brian Lyman, a reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser. He's in the newsroom there. Hi, Brian.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, how much is this race about Mitch McConnell?
Up until this point, or until about 2 weeks ago, it had really been about Donald Trump and how much the Republican candidates wanted to pledge their loyalty to Donald Trump. When Trump started attacking Sessions about 2 weeks ago, that sort of froze the strategies of the different campaigns. And that combined with the failure of the Obamacare repeal, which a lot of the Republican candidates have made a priority, emboldened the Republican candidates, particularly Roy Moore and Mo Brooks, to go on the attack against Mitch McConnell, who, as you mentioned, is backing Luther Strange in the primary.
Well, just to give people a sense of what's going on here, let's listen here to an ad by Mo Brooks, who is currently a U.S. representative.
Luther Strange, he isn't telling the truth again. I wrote a $2,500 check to help President Trump beat Hillary. And in Congress, I vote with President Trump 95% of the time. So who are you going to believe? Mitch McConnell and Luther Strange? Or conservative thought leaders like Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, Ann Coulter, and Mark Levin? They have all endorsed me for Senate because I support President Trump's America First agenda.
Tell us more about Mo Brooks, first of all, and his campaign.
Brooks was elected to Congress in 2010 as part of the Tea Party vanguard. There's no real moderate Republican in this race, but Brooks is very much in the mold of a real states' rights purist kind of Republican. He's really like the spokesman for what you would consider the Tea Party platform in the state of Alabama.
And what about Roy Moore, who is famous around the country for refusing to take down a Ten Commandments monument at the Alabama Supreme Court when he was Chief Justice? What's his campaign about?
Roy Moore's campaign right now is the same campaign Roy Moore has run at the state level for the past 17 years. He's running as a man who believes in faith in the public sphere and as someone who wants to bring, you know, conservative social values, not only to Alabama, but to the entire country. When you talk to Moore about, you know, like particular policy issues, like, let's say, you know, health care or other matters, he seems to be a little reluctant to talk about details on that front. But his message today is the same message that he had going back to his first race for Chief Justice in 2000, that he's going to advocate for faith-based voters.
And that brings us to Luther Strange, who was appointed to fill Sessions' seat until the special election. He's been in Washington since February, and Mitch McConnell is throwing a lot of money behind him.
He is, yeah. McConnell probably does not want Roy Moore or Mo Brooks in the Senate caucus. Strange is more likely to stay on the farm than those two have. And in fact, both Moore and Brooks have in recent weeks made it clear that they're not going to support McConnell. Brooks even called for him to resign if he couldn't get the Obamacare repeal done. McConnell, too, I think, is seeing this race as a test for 2018 and whether you can protect Republican incumbents from primary challengers. If if one of these challengers were to unseat Strange, that could embolden other Republicans around the country to challenge incumbents.
Now, Strange was appointed by Governor Robert Bentley, who resigned in April, embroiled in a scandal. Has his connection to the governor hurt him at all?
That is something that keeps coming up in the race, and certainly something that his opponents want you to know. Strange has basically tried to frame this appointment as saying that, you know, I took this because I think we could advance a conservative agenda and I could help Donald Trump. But it's something that that's following him around throughout the campaign.
Sounds like it's rough politics in Alabama.
There's never any other kind.
Now, does a Democrat have a chance of winning the special election against any of these guys?
The only chance a Democrat has is if Roy Moore gets the nomination, because Moore is a very divisive figure within the Alabama Republican Party. He has strong adherence, and he has a lot of folks, particularly on the business side of things, who want nothing to do with him. If Moore gets the nomination, a Democrat has a better chance of winning, but it's still going to be a tough slog for them going forward.
That's Brian Lyman, who's a reporter for the Montgomery Advertiser, talking with us about the politics right now in Alabama, where there's a special election to fill Jeff Sessions' Senate seat. Brian, thanks.
Hey, thanks so much.
And as we close out the hour, Robin, President Trump's immigration plan has a focus on bringing in people who speak English. Two oddities of the English language caught our attention today. Mm-hmm. We had two chiefs of staff on the show today, not chiefs, even though the plural of thief is thieves. And one of them told us about compliment with an E versus compliment with an I. There are two spellings. Look it up. Tough language.
You better get the attorneys general in this.
Yep. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.